morning, Matt.
Good morning, Bill. Welcome to the DMZ.
It's great to be here at the DMZ.
Love it in the DMZ. It's a balmy, like, 72 and sunny every day in the DMZ. It's
much better weather than New England generally.
Yeah, I mean, the weather outside, it could be blustery, cold, rainy, but here we are snug inside the warm, moist DMZ. It's amazing here. Love it.
The big political news today is the end of Senator Richard Lugar's 36-year senatorial career. Democrats are showering him with praise now that he has been defeated. And he took a big swipe at the Tea Party in his concession statement. And I imagine that conservatives are very excited that they feel they got rid of another apostate. But is there any kind of grinding of teeth that, you know, we tried this with Joe Miller, we tried this with Christine O'Donnell, we tried it with Ken Buck. You know, maybe there's some states where, you know, if the guy goes off the party line a couple of times, it just shouldn't be that big of a deal.
Well, look, a few things there, Bill. I mean, first of all, the guy didn't live in Indiana. And my colleague Will Ron really deserves a lot of credit for breaking that story. He hasn't really gotten it. But back on January 30th, he wrote a piece titled Dick Lugar Doesn't Live Here Anymore. And as far as I know, he was the first national journalist to point out the residency issue. And I think that really hurt Lugar. And regardless of political ideology, if you like moderates, you sort of have to live in your state or at least have a pretense of living in your state. So that was a huge problem. Lugar had been there so long.
Do you think this was not an ideological vote that the voters took, that it was more about a guy who had become detached from his home base?
That's my guess. I mean, you know, clearly there was an ideological component to it. I think clearly conservatives and Tea Party folks will kind of take great solace in this. Now, what's going to happen is next week you go to Nebraska. The conservative favorite there is probably a guy named Stenberg. He does not appear to be doing that well. That could sort of undermine a little bit of the notion that the spirit of 2010 is still alive. But there's races in Texas and Utah and other states. And here's the interesting thing, Bill, is that let me also digress and say Richard Murdoch is not like a Christine O'Donnell who's never been elected before. He's a state treasurer of Indiana. So he is, you know, an elected official. It's a little bit different than some of those races that Republicans lost in 2010. But I think the interesting thing is even if Republicans and conservatives don't win all these primary fights, and even if they don't elect, you know, win general elections, the odds are pretty good that you're going to see two or three more conservatives in the mold of Jim DeMint, Marco Rubio, Rand Paul joining that block in the Senate. And that's a huge, huge deal. Even if only a few of them are added, you swap out a Dick Lugar for a Richard Murdoch. That's a very important thing in terms of Jim DeMint's vision, I would say, of having a solid conservative block, not just Republicans, in the Senate.
So your Democrats are trying to make this into a pickup opportunity. If he's a more seasoned person than a Christine O'Donnell, this was a race that would probably be totally unwinnable for Democrats if Lugar was ranked for re-election. And they're trying to make the case that here's a guy who is on the political fringe, that he took a lawsuit out to try to to stop the auto bailout or just to try to undermine it in a certain way, but certainly opposed to the bailout. And Indiana is a state that has, you know, auto factories in it. Is there any concern that what Lugar did that conservatives didn't like was he voted for Obama's judicial nominees. He supported TARP. He helped the Obama administration with the SALT Treaty. And I'm not aware of much else. I mean, the guy was a pretty reliable party vote on, you know, 95% of things.
Well, it wasn't just the Supreme Court nominees. I did a study about a month ago where I looked through Obama appointments that came through the judiciary that had come out of the Judiciary Committee. So mostly judicial appointments, but not exclusively. It also included like Solicitor General sort of thing. And Lugar was like the number of all the Republicans. I think he was the number two or number three Republican that voted most with Obama. So they had legitimate reason, I think. You know, conservatives had legitimate reason to be skeptical.
But isn't it a fairly – I mean, this is from a philosophy that – I mean, as Republicans used to say, you know, elections have consequences. Let's not – let's have up or down votes on nominees. Let the president – let's not completely handcuff the president's ability to staff the executive branch. And you can disagree with that, of course, but is that – is that enough? Is that a big enough ideological problem to say I will risk losing this seat over it? That's what seems strange to me.
Well, I mean, first of all, I would say that my guess is that it's still likely that Republicans will retain the seat. Although you never know, and it's why they have the elections. Murdoch is an elected official. So the odds of him making a really bad gaffe are probably less than if he were some dude who just showed up. I think groups like the Club for Growth that were instrumental in helping oust Lugar will probably try to help Murdoch actually win a general. So I think Murdoch probably has the upper hand. It's probably likely that he will be the U.S. Senator, although anything could happen. But I do think judicial appointments and judges are very important. Now, look, even Jim DeMint, according to my little study that I put together, even DeMint voted for 50% of Obama's judges. So it's not like he was reflexively against them. I mean, even DeMint was 50-50. But the fact is that Lugar was, you know, I think tied with Scott Brown and behind, I think, Susan Collins, somebody, one of the main senators. When you look to the, you know, potential Supreme Court picks, I mean, that is important. Conservatives really care about that for obvious reasons. So we'll have to see how it goes. Now, there is this storyline that says Republicans are ousting the moderates who can make deals and get things done. But are things really getting done? I mean, it's really hard.
Well, I think it's a very important point. And I think there's a converse argument to be made here that as far as moderate Republicans go, Lugar was a pretty worthless one as far as getting things done is concerned. He didn't go off the party line very often. He didn't put himself out there and say, I mean, here's someone who made some slight feints on issues like immigration and cap and trade, for example, but he never really put his neck out and said I'm gonna, you know, work hand in hand with Democrats. There's some principles that I'm gonna hold on to. I'm gonna you know, make compromises. I'm not gonna just take whatever Democrats give me. But it's important that we solve these problems, and I'm gonna put together a group of like-minded Republicans to get something done. He rarely did that. He basically did it on foreign policy. And David Corn, Brother Jones, you know, wrote an important piece, I thought, talking about what he did behind the scenes to get the START Treaty passed most recently. Not that it's insignificant, but he certainly didn't use that attitude on a range of issues when arguably he had the political capital to do so. And if you want to really take a stand, as he claims to want to be, talking about being bipartisan in his statement, you know, like most of the time he fell short of that mark. So he got caught in between.
And there's a little bit less
space to stand on.
Right. I mean, and I think you're right. And also, just he was just there so long. And I mean, I'm not in favor of term limits, but this is the voters term limiting someone, and I think it's fine and healthy. So
this is perhaps less of an ideological question. I was actually discussing this with my mother-in-law the other day. you know, what makes a man who's 80 years old, who's had a very distinguished career, you know, insist upon doing this for another 6 years when, I mean, he had to have known it was going to be a race. I mean, people are sort of attacking him for having a lackadaisical campaign strategy, but I don't think that's quite fair. He knew he had a race going on. I don't think he lollygagged it. But why not just say, I've had a good run. I've had 36 years in the Senate. I'm 80 years old. I'm going to, I only got years left on this earth. I'm going to relax. What makes a guy want to keep doing it till the absolute bitter end? That's a little bit hard to get one's head around.
That's a great question. I think, I don't know, but I've wondered this myself, and it's not just in politics. It's in other areas, entertainment, sports, you know, the guy who keeps hanging on, one more fight. It's really dangerous in boxing when you get these guys who are over the hill who come back for another payday and, you know, get brain injury or something in the process. I have to imagine it's a combination of factors. One is probably they – first of all, they're weird. They're not like us. You don't get elected to the U.S. Senate.
You and I are pinnacles of normalcy.
Yeah. I mean, like, to get where they are, they have to be – they have to have this drive, and presumably that drive is good and helpful, and it's also – it's a double-edged sword. It keeps you going maybe when you should give it up. I mean, I think that Newt Gingrich sort of had that same thing when he wouldn't quit his campaign. Because the same thing that made him crazy enough to think he could become the speaker and wrest control after 40 years from the Democrats made him believe that he could, you know, become the nominee after it was obvious he couldn't. I think there's maybe a sense that you die when you quit working. I mean, I don't know what else these guys have to live for. It could be that they have made sacrifices throughout their career where they didn't have a really balanced life before. Maybe they have a family, but they've always sort of been married to their work. And maybe they think that's the purpose of life is work, and if they quit working, they're going to quit living.
That probably explains more than anything. I mean, the one thing that I would also understand is if you really wanted to get one last thing done to cement your legacy, you know, and I see, you know, some people thought John Kerry would pack in after coming short of the presidency, but clearly he wants to have one big thing that people can point to and say that he did. You know, and he tried it on global warming, and I think he's tried it on a couple other issues, and he hasn't quite gone yet. So I get that drive, but you know, Luger, I have a harder time understanding because he doesn't really do that very often in the first place. So I don't get what he's sticking around to try to do.
I feel like I'd walk away and sort of like be feted and have people introduce me, call me senator for the rest of my life. It is different. It is weird, but obviously there's a drive. I mean, because this is like a trend. This reminds me also the Robert Caro book about Lyndon Johnson called "The Path to Power." One of the ways that Johnson got to the Senate and got to be got to be kind of a big deal was he sucked up to Speaker Rayburn, and he saw that Rayburn really, like, he hated Sundays because there wasn't work to do on Sunday. You know, like, he really liked regular work days. And so Johnson would, like, as I recall, I read the book years ago, would, like, go over to his house and, like, read the papers with him. And, like, there is this thing where these guys love working. And it may seem weird to us, but they love the intricacies, the parliamentary procedure, all that. Inside baseball stuff.
Right. But I still don't get, I mean, you can love all that and still say, okay, I can only do this for so long. I can keep busy. I can be involved in politics and not hold the Senate seat. You know, I can write memoirs. I could explain to the world all the things that I learned and tell all the inside stories and all that kind of stuff. You know, why you have to actually be in the crucible, you know, in your 80s. When again, when you're Luger, I don't get what he's doing on a day-to-day basis.
At some point, too, I would also suspect that like the competitive thing comes out. Like if somebody wants to take you down, then it's not about keeping the seat; it's about stopping them and beating them and not giving them the opportunity or the pleasure of taking you. I mean, it becomes like a competitive thing not real. I mean, that's not the best reason to run for right. Senate, but I think that that's part of it.
So the other big flap this week is when Joe Biden said, I meet the press, he's very comfortable with the concept of gay marriage, and it sparked all these stories again about Obama's strained relationship with the gay community and with liberals in general. Why can't he just say what his vice president said, and what his secretary of education said, and what Secretary of HUD said? Why does he do this dance? I don't know if if you have a particular take on it. I personally find that it's sort of ludicrous to say he is insufficient from a gay rights perspective. This is clearly the greatest advancements in gay rights have happened on his watch and because of his actions. The repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He's called on all federal agencies to extend full partner benefits to federal employees. He's already told the Justice Department don't defend the Defense of Marriage Act because it's unconstitutional. You know, all the things that are related to marriage that are actually under his authority, he is doing. He can't wave his hand and make gay marriage happen. It's a state issue. There's no federal marriage licenses. So everything that he has done, he can do, and there'd be symbolic import in saying he's for gay marriage. I don't deny that, but to somehow say that everything else he's done doesn't amount to very much, or just, as some folks have said, I think on both sides of the fence, both Obama and Romney are against gay marriage. Well, that's very technically true, but almost even not completely, because when there is a gay marriage initiative on the state level, Obama's always for it. He celebrated when New York State passed gay marriage. He didn't say this was a bad idea. He fought against the North Carolina marriage amendment the anti-gay marriage amendment that just passed. Obama was against that. So it is oversimplifying to the point of being inaccurate just to say he's against gay marriage, because if he was against it completely, he'd be against it at the state level, which he's not. So it's this very sliver here that he's not just flat out saying yes, I'm for a period, but everything else he is for, and in a way that has been very substantially beneficial to the gay community. So I would be surprised if it actually became something that dragged him down with the base at the end. He has a story to tell to gay Americans, to liberals, to gay donors. And he has a foil on Romney, who is someone who not only is against all these things, but just had this whole flap with Richard Grenell we've talked about the past couple of weeks. So I don't know if you think Republicans are going to try to make some hay with this and try to drive some wedges here, seeing an opportunity and perhaps trying to not play up the things that I'm talking about.
So I think an interesting thing is that, and I think earlier I said fetid. That I would become fetid. Mm-hmm. Is that?
That's a word.
It's having an offensive odor or being celebrated. I'm not sure. So either way, that's what I would do
right.
if I were out of the Senate. But I'm just anyway. I think a couple things. One, I think that conservatives suspect that you're right that Obama is sort of. In the closet about his support of gay marriage. I think that if you're a conservative or a Republican, you say you can't have it both ways. You have to take a stand. I think if you're a liberal, the concern is while you're right about everything you said, I think if you're a liberal, if you firmly believe that this is, that marriage equality is a civil right or is a great cause to champion, then you would want Obama to sort of heroically be a champion of it, to use the rhetoric the bully pulpit and sort of, you know, summon Americans to embrace this.
Well, that to me is one of the great...
Obviously he's not doing that.
One of the great weaknesses, perhaps of both sides of the fence, but being a little closer to liberalism, that you get this sense that if you're not following this one path to success, you're not using your bully pulpit, you're not speaking plainly, if you're not doing that, then everything else rings hollow. That proves to me that you're not really 100% on my team with this. Some folks just don't take a broader view and say, you know what, there's more to one path to success sometimes. And I'm not saying there isn't an argument. I mean, I've actually made the argument in my own book about why it makes sense to speak very plainly about support for gay marriage, and there's a way to talk about that would not be alien to others. So I get the argument. But I've also seen this president in the past 3 years play a different game with great success. So why should I, dump on that and say, well, you're not doing it my way, and say, you know what, then maybe there is a way to get to the same place without maybe kicking up the same amount of dust. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're weak about it. It just means you might be playing a bit more of a finesse game, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
The big debate over what strategy works and the role of a president in terms of should they, how important is rhetorical leadership versus sort of stealth policy enactment. The other interesting point that I'd make is that Gary Johnson, the former governor of New Mexico, who is now the Libertarian nominee for president, is making an issue of this. He is very pro-gay marriage and is attacking Obama for not showing, for not taking a stand. Now, I don't know if that's going to resonate. I don't know if Johnson's going to be able to, use this as a wedge issue or to peel some Obama voters away. But it's interesting. It'd be something to keep an eye on.
Now, is it possible, we have talked about the issues that Romney has had with the gay Republican community recently. Does a Gary Johnson candidacy threaten both sides in this respect? Can he attract younger liberals who think Obama is not sufficient on social liberal matters? And can he appeal to gay conservatives or gay friendly conservatives who say Romney is not square with you on a range of issues, and he's not truly libertarian when it comes to individual rights like this. And does that present a problem? I mean, Romney seems to at least be somewhat clumsy in how he's gone about this in recent weeks. Does that speak to the fact that there is a constituency here that he may not be serving properly?
I think that both major party candidates are probably playing the issue about right in terms of what they have to do and say politically. And I'm skeptical of the notion that a libertarian candidate can gain a lot of traction. But what I think is interesting is that this means he very well could, even though it might be a small percentage of votes, he could take votes from Obama potentially, as much as he takes votes from Romney. And I haven't done the numbers, but he was governor of New Mexico. Could he, how important is New Mexico this cycle? Could he get enough votes there and take enough votes, say, from Obama there or from Romney there to make a difference? I mean, in a close electoral, I'm very skeptical of Gary Johnson and that he will have any impact or be relevant in this race, but who knows?
If there's a place where he would make an impact, it would theoretically be New Mexico, be his home state. And I'd be curious to see some polling.
Me too.
And typically libertarian, to the extent that they take votes from anybody, tends to be more from the right than the left. And maybe with Johnson would be different because he's seen as so, pro-drug legalization as well as pro-gay rights. So maybe he has a different
right.
mix here.
And I mean, on one hand, he was obviously a Republican governor. He ran for the Republican nomination this year. On the other hand, I mean, he's also pro-choice, too.
Right.
So, I mean, he's pro-choice, he's pro-gay marriage. I think there is a chance. I mean, I think it's a long shot, but, I think he could tap – he could. There's a chance that some young people could get excited by him.
Now, we weren't planning to talk about this, so forgive me if I'm going down an odd path. But there's actually going to be a range of third-party candidates this year, as there are most years. We already have Virgil Good, who is the Democrat congressman turned Republican congressman turned independent congressman. I think I have that trajectory right. But he now has the nomination of the Constitution Party, which is an historically, you know, fringe right-wing party. Buddy Romer is trying to get the nomination on the Reform Party ticket, which is Ross Perot's old party, as well as trying to make a play for that whole Americans Elect thing, which has been struggling to get off the ground. But it's plausible that he has a line on the ballot, and he is a former Democrat and Republican governor of Louisiana who tried
and
to run the
Republican.
Right, a congressman too, and he's running big on campaign finance, which is more of a liberal issue than a conservative issue. So he's trying to make a whole issue about big corporate money in politics. That might have some appeal to the disgruntled left. And I know Roseanne Barr is making a play for the Green Party nomination. I don't know who else in the Green Party is competing, so I don't know if they're going to say she gets it or not. You may have a cacophony of voices here appealing to all the various fringe elements of the political scheme, which is pretty typical, actually. There's usually a bunch of folks, and they usually don't amount to very much. They usually don't tip the election. Although I think some of these voices might be a little bit more higher profile than usual. The likelihood is that it's all a wash and won't amount to much, but perhaps if there are certain swing states where the margins will be very close, like perhaps New Mexico, maybe a hometown boy has a shot of having an impact there, but also could be that there's so many of these voices, they cancel each other out, and no one can really galvanize enough media attention to get people aware that they're running to make an impact, and that's probably the more likely outcome.
Yeah, let me say that I think it's a shame that Buddy Romer was not given a platform to be in the debates, because he's got the best, or, you know, arguably the best resume of anybody who ran, and he didn't even have the opportunity to really get his message out.
It's strange that he couldn't get in debates, whereas Johnson and Huntsman could. I mean, it's not like those guys are polling so great. I don't know what happened behind the scenes there. The guy was a governor. I mean, it's not like he's a nobody. I mean, geez, perfectly proper resume to run for president. I don't know why he couldn't get even like the basic amount of respect from the process.
It was a shame. And unfortunately, Bill, I'm going to have to cut this short. I have to supposedly, we'll see if somebody picks up, but I'm supposed to call Richard Murdoch right now to talk about his victory last night.
So you'll be reporting on that on your Daily Caller blog in short order?
Ideally, yes, I would. there's a chance I call him, and he's busy. He's talking to Chuck Todd or something. But as everyone knows, we normally have our big idea of the week. So I think we'll have to put that on hold for next week.
All right.
But it's become a popular segment. And let's keep an eye on these third-party things, because I do think it's unlikely to be a huge factor. But who knows? It's interesting.
All right. Well, until then, I hate to see you walk away from the DMC so quickly. I know warm and cozy and moist in here.
It's nice. It's nice. We'll see you back here next week on the DMZ. Thank you, Bill.
Take care.
Always a pleasure.